You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, e whakarongo nā koe ki Te Wire ma irirangi poho I tēnei rā. Tērā te kaumātahi o Pautū Te Rangi. Kia ora, you're listening to The Wire on 95 BFM for today, the 11th of March. Ko Bronwyn Wild tōku ingoa. My name is Bronny, formerly the host of The Wednesday Wire, and back after a summer hiatus, if you couldn't tell from my forgetting how to use the buttons in the studio. I'm helping to cover from Justin today, who'll be back next week. And boy, we have a stacked show today, so let's get into it. E whai ake nei coming up in the show today. We speak to Minister Andrew Little talking about the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission report, the National Party's board review into the 2020 election, and commemorations and policy action 2 years on from the March 15th terror attacks. Anika from yesterday's show spoke to Manu Kalon from Merge Cafe on K Road and how they need help to continue the great work they do supporting the homeless community. A neighbourhood watch, Zoe Kondanis from Radio Adelaide, talks about a possible case of COVID-19 spread through wastewater and an update on the allegations of sexual assault against Attorney General Christian Porter. We've got a new segment with the Auckland University Students Association President Anamika Hariraj. And then lastly, a story with my very own sister, Maya Wild, about how zebrafish grooving to MC Hammer's Can't Touch This can help us understand the auditory system in people with autism spectrum disorder. It's going to be a big show, and hea hau whakaaro, I'd love to hear your thoughts throughout. So tuku pātuhi mai, you can send me a text on 5395 or waia mai nā nei. Give me a call on 309 3879. Kaua e wareware, e āhei ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihere rukiruki, maronga te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho. Me haere ki 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website. I tēnei wā, tonu ingari. Now it's time for...
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
This week with Health Minister Andrew Little, we spoke about the National Party's decision not to allow its MPs to have a copy of the report into last year's election. And with March 15th on Monday, marking 2 years since the Christchurch terror attacks, I asked the Minister about the government's plans to commemorate and also take policy action. To begin with, however, we spoke about the initial Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission report, Mā Rongo Te Ake, through listening and hearing. It evaluated the government's response to He Ara Oranga, the 2018 inquiry into mental health and addiction. I began by asking the Minister what progress has been made since then.
There's a number of things that the initial Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission records as having been achieved. So we've set up the initial Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission, we've set up the permanent one, we've set up the Suicide Prevention Office. We've got a number of programs underway, not the least of which is the Access and Choice program. I think the initial Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission acknowledges that the decisions made in May 2019 as a consequence of the November 2018 report is a 4 to 5 year program of change. At the time they put that report together, we are 18 months through it, so we're not even quite 2 years yet through it at the moment. And so we're making progress and they acknowledge that. I think what they picked up is justifiably many in the sector are saying, look, we just wish it could happen faster. Some people have said the change is inconsistent, and it's partly because I think negotiating with DHBs, with community providers and with others, it's not going to be all the same around the country at the same time, bearing in mind that we've given ourselves this 4 to 5 year period to achieve the change that the report in 2018 said needs to happen. So, look, it's a very important check-in about progress, but, of course, we're nowhere near completed yet, and we've got a long way to go.
And so some on the ground are concerned that the investment has been ad hoc, too slow and not targeting the right areas. Why do you think it is that the change hasn't been what some of the people on the ground, on the front lines, envisaged?
Yeah, like just in response to the substantive criticism, the change that we're doing is the change that He Ara Oranga outlines. And they said the principal gap that we have in mental health and addiction services at the moment is help and services for those with mild to moderate mental health issues. So the people who are not turning up to hospitals with acute conditions, but who are feeling anxious, who are feeling depressed. And so that's been the focus of what we've done. And we've got this program of work where we work with GP clinics and community organisations and others to provide skilled people who can do the talk therapies and the others at that sort of level. So needing to get that around right around the country across literally hundreds and hundreds of GP practices, of community and other frontline health organisations, there's a capacity issue, so it's going to be for those organisations to pick up, the people who can pick up the additional roles that are being funded. And that's one of the challenges that we've got. So people may well say, look, it's inconsistent or it's patchy, because it's going to be, because that's the nature of backfilling a major workforce gap that we've got. But it is doing the right thing and the right way as contemplated by the original 2018 report. So to the extent that people are saying it's the wrong thing, I reject that. To the extent people are saying it's happening in a disordered sort of way, I get that that's what it looks like, but that is the nature of making a significant change over a long period of time and moving at a pace that different organisations can move at in partnership with the Ministry of Health.
And a big part of that report was the implementation of kaupapa Māori principles, and I wondered how the government has or is planning on incorporating that in a way that's genuine and not tokenistic.
Yeah, and that's very important, and it's one of the things I've been talking to the Ministry a lot about, is making sure that the way we engage kaupapa Māori services and services that are there to support Māori is not just the standard kind of contracting, competitive sort of tendering model, that actually we're collaborating with organisations and getting the best out of it. And I'm confident that actually the processes that the Ministry are using now is doing that. They are in the throes of engaging right now with kaupapa Māori and Pacifica services for the very reason of getting the relationship right, getting the principles right, and engaging properly with those organisations to get services going. So we're pretty close to finalising some arrangements with a range of organisations to do just that.
And lastly, I know another group that the Commission heard from was the Rainbow Community, and I was wondering what steps Labor has taken towards upholding your election promise to provide mental health services focused on the Rainbow Community.
Yeah, we have. I haven't had direct engagement with Rainbow Community leaders on the kind of new services. Some of the services that we've operated, particularly at the young people in Rangatahi kind of level, there are some specifically directed at young members of the Rainbow Community. But we know that, look, there's more that has to be done in that regard. I think the big piece of policy work that we're focused on that has a mental health dimension to it is the gay conversion therapy ban, which we're working on at the moment as well. So we'll come at that at a number of fronts. But I'm acutely aware that in terms of direct engagement about new expectations or expectations of new services, that is yet to happen in relation to the Rainbow Community.
To move on to our second topic for today, I know the National Party Board has published its review into the 2020 election and what went wrong for the party. Now, Judith Collins has said she's allowed the MPs to read the report, and that in itself is a concession, but not to actually have a copy. How does that sound to you, just as a gut reaction?
Yeah, look, I don't want to get drawn into the National Party's internal sort of issues. It's for them to do. That said, I mean, look, all parties do a review of their elections, whether they're regarded as being successful or not. And Labor's had plenty of elections recently where it hasn't been particularly successful. But we always do a review, and we're open with each other about it and with the party membership about it. And typically those reports get published. So it is a bit unusual from MPs of a party who will be reflecting on a pretty disastrous result for them historically, and to not be trusted to take a report away in their own time and consider it and read it and reflect on it is an unusual step for a major political party to take. But in the end, that's a matter for the National Party.
And when you're talking about Labor in the past having done similar reviews of similarly unsuccessful elections, would that be published to the general public? And do you think it's important for voters to know what went on?
Well, I think it's important for voters to see that parties can honestly reflect on what went wrong and in that case, also in some cases, what went right. But certainly the result is not as expected. And you want to make sure, you know, were all the elements in place? Was there good campaign leadership? Were there good campaign resources? How did the fundraising go? Was everybody in the loop and sort of getting the daily messages and all that sort of stuff? I mean, I think the public needs to know as a matter of confidence in a big political party that they can be open and honest with themselves about, you know, the things that need to change. And that, you know, people do need to see that, and that's certainly the view that the Labor Party has always taken.
Do you think you will ever get to know the contents of that report? Are you curious at all?
Oh, look, you know, and I don't want to be unkind to the National Party because Labor's been through this experience before, but that was a difficult election result for the National Party last year. But when that happens, the next big question for leadership is to face up to it and be open and honest about it. Open up to your colleagues and say, right, that didn't go so well, so what do we have to do, you know, to make the change? And part of being a political party in a democracy like this is that you've got to demonstrate to the public that you're up for that internal conversation. And I think saying that, you know, MPs can read it but they can't take it away just shows, I don't know, a level or a spirit of distrust that doesn't look good.
Well, then to move on to our last topic for today, Andrew, I know that March 15th is coming up next week, and I was wondering what the government's plans were to commemorate the lives lost in the Christchurch terror attacks.
There's a commemoration activity on Saturday, on the 13th, with the communities there and the broader Christchurch community. So there'll be that. The other thing, I mean, the government's been obviously actively considering the Royal Commission's recommendations. So I'm hoping we'll be in a position in the next couple of days to make some announcements about some specific things we're doing in pursuit of those recommendations. Some of the recommendations are stuff that is long-term, increasing the diversity of the public service, having the public debate about social inclusion and being accepting of minority faith and ethnic communities, some of the stuff around the security agencies. But there's stuff that is more short-term, and I'm hoping we'll be in a position to announce some specifics in relation to the short-term initiatives in relation to supporting minority communities and things like that.
And as part of that, also in response to the recent report by the Muslim community, which supported the recommendations of the commission?
Yeah, I mean, and my colleague Priyanka Radhakrishnan have had some pretty good engagement with both the Muslim community and other faith communities and minority ethnic communities. The report from the Federation of Islamic Associations, FIANS, is a good report, and they've set out a tracker that they put together for keeping a track of the implementation of the recommendations. But they've come up with some very useful suggestions. We've been working with the Islamic Women's Council as well. They're a very important voice. And there's some other Muslim organisations too, which we need to take account of as we put together some of the restorative aspects of what the Royal Commission has recommended as we restore their relationship.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little. The Wire.
E whakarongo nā koe ki te rangi pōho, you're listening to 95 BFM. Ka hoki mai mātou, amuri I tēnei. We'll be right back after some ads.
Auckland Arts Festival brings you Shefu and the Crates, Return of the Navigator, live at the Auckland Town Hall this Saturday. Celebrating the 20th anniversary of his bona fide classic album Navigator, Shefu and his band the Crates bring you a once-in-a-lifetime performance. Shefu and the Crates, Return of the Navigator, with support from Team Dynamite, Ruby Doo and DJ Manuel Bundy, this Saturday at the Auckland Town Hall. Get your tickets now from aaf.co.nz.
Earthbeat Festival, Aotearoa's most innovative and earth-friendly music and arts festival. End your summer with a blast with 5 days of music, dance, art and over 100 workshops. Live performances from Solarosa, Paddy Free, Macy Rika, Josh Butler, King Kapisi and more. All just over an hour away from Auckland CBD, March 17th to 21st, Atiu Creek Regional Park. Last round of tickets are selling fast. Go to earthbeatfestival.com. It's the beat that connects us.
Were you at the Radical Maris noise gig on Friday? I never thought seven dudes playing saxophones would change my mind about capitalism, but hello.
Then
2 hours of Nightcore remixes of Every Time We Touch.
What even?
And a white guy did a rap about feelings.
What?
So beautiful.
What?
Stay in the loop with the 95BFM Entertainment Guide. Online and on air 7 days a week, 3 times a day, 10:20 a.m., 3 p.m., and 6:20 p.m. It's gigs in there. And don't forget, the Auckland Arts Festival is on now. Go to aaf.co.nz.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Merge Cafe is an establishment on Karangahape Road run by LifeWise that supports Auckland's homeless whānau. Since 2010, Merge Cafe has been a place for patrons from all walks of life, offering a warm, safe and supportive space where everyone is welcome. Following COVID-19, the cafe found themselves in a financially compromising position and are now campaigning to raise the $60,000 needed in order to stay open by the end of the month. Anika spoke to manager Manu Kalon and began by asking him to tell us a bit more about Merge and the support they offer the community.
Yeah, so Merge Cafe opened in about 11 years ago, in 2009, late 2009. And Merge is a pathway, or a drop-in center and a cafe for people who experience homelessness to be able to access food and a connection and sense of belongingness. And that's why we call ourselves Merge. And life. So Merge Cafe has welcomed and supported people from all walks of life, just, you know, bringing them together and, you know, sharing a great meal, engage over in a conversation over a cup of coffee, tea. And so there's free internet here. People can access that. If you're living rough, then you can charge your phones. We have a couple of computers, so if you want to look at from properties to move into, because we also provide support for housing and you know, make your CV, find a job, and we'll help you with your documentation and all that. So the cafe support Auckland's homeless whānau, breaking down these societal barriers and all over, like, and offer a warm, safe and supportive place. We don't judge anyone. There's no judgment in this place, and everyone's welcome. And there's two teams. Sorry, one important thing. So we have a Merge Cafe and community. So Merge community is basically, we have peer support workers who give wraparound services. So it's a drop-in center. People can come in if you don't have food, clothes, to place to stay, and we'll help you out.
So I understand that you need 60 grand in order to keep the cafe open and running.
Yeah.
What is, realistically, what's the best bet of you guys getting that money?
Look, I'm positive. I talk to people every day. I'm in the cafe pretty much every day, and I feel the pulse of the community, and the response has been huge after this campaign's going really, really good. And I'm actually really overwhelmed by the response by Aucklanders, and also Kiwis living in different parts of Aotearoa, and it's just it's amazing, and I'm 100% sure that we'll pull through.
Cool. How much support do you receive from LifeWise?
We used to get a lot of support from LifeWise, but in the last two and a half years, our major funds came from the big sleep out that LifeWise used to do every year, and we would raise somewhere around 300k each every year, and that was to support the cafe and what we do. But since COVID last year, we couldn't do it last year. I don't think it's happening this year due to the level changes and the volatility what's happening. And a year before that, we also had a Merge and Dine specific to Merge Cafe campaign. We had, like, people come over, there was food and everything and donations and auctions and everything. So we raised about 60 or 70K from that as well. So that money has stopped. But LifeWise does support us, and that's why it's matching each donation that comes through. So if I donate $100, they're going to match it with another $100. That's how it works.
And you guys don't receive any support from the government, do you?
No, no. This, because we are a business, mostly, because it's a social, so we are to for profit, but we have a social side of. So it's a loss-making business as well, but at least the money that was used to get before through the business as well, because all the locals here, office goers, and they've been working from home, so they used to pay forward because we have a paid forward model that's to keep us afloat. You can pay for someone else's food or coffee or, you know, but that's also kind of stopped. So, but we don't get any donations to answer your question directly, and not from the government.
Would you like to see some sort of level of government support and, like, just to acknowledge the work that you guys are doing in the community?
Yes, definitely. There's a need. I mean, there's other organizations that are doing maybe a better things than we do, or they're bigger and broader. But we are trying to make a difference here through a small cafe. So if we get more funding through the government and more recognition from the government, we can actually expand. So it's, instead of having one merge, we can have two merge, three merge, and one in South Auckland, one in wherever we are needed, where we can make a difference in people's lives. So I think that's the idea. But so, yeah, recognition and some funding will be great from the government.
Now, obviously, Merge has cultivated quite a significant community of people who you help and who you help support. In the worst case scenario that the cafe will have to shut down, what kind of support systems will be available to that community?
So, because, like you said, we have cultivated we've developed this community on K Road, especially in Auckland Central, and we bonded people together. From it is very strong sense of belongingness here. So there's there's a lot of turmoil that we are seeing already. People come to me, and it's very emotional since we went out, and we are making these appeals. And people are coming, if this closes down, this merge closes down, what are we going to do? That's the question that's, people are always asking me, especially after all of this campaign has started. So I think what we are doing is good, but there's Auckland City Mission, which we work really closely with, which is not far from here. But I think that'll be the closest one for Auckland City people who are isolated or on margin from shoestring budgets or homeless. That's the only other place I could think of which is really close to us in the central.
What kind of timeline are we looking at that you have to sort of raise this money by?
Realistically, it's 31st of March because we have rents to pay and bills to pay, and the budgets are looking really, really tight. But as I said, the campaign is going really good, and we are receiving donations as we speak. 31st of March is the deadline for us.
That was 95 BFM producer Anika speaking to Manu Kralon from Merge Cafe. And like he said, you can make donations via the LifeWise website.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
This week on Neighbourhood Watch, we have an update on Australian Attorney General Christian Porter, who is facing allegations of sexual assault. So please, if you don't want to hear about sexual assault and suicide right now, Zoe gives you a warning when that piece comes on and you can tune out. Before we spoke about that, however, Zoe Konardis from Radio Adelaide talks about a new COVID case which is thought to have been spread through wastewater. And she started by talking about this is all happening in the middle of the Fringe Festival.
Adelaide right now is currently hosting its annual Fringe event, so an arts festival very similar to the one in Edinburgh. And we're very lucky that we were able to have ours this year. Last year's Fringe, the end of Fringe, also marked the start of coronavirus. So it's amazing that we've been able to host this year. And unfortunately, Sunday morning, SA Health have reported that they found some COVID-19 results in the wastewater testing that they conduct from Adelaide CBD. So Deputy Chief Public Health Officer has said that these further testings that have been done on this wastewater have ruled out that the result was not a mistake and it didn't come from a returned traveller or a Medi hotel worker. They reported on Sunday and they said that it comes from the northeastern portion of Adelaide, which is unfortunately where a lot of fringe festival events are being held right now. In saying that, there has been no change to restrictions and no public panic as of yet, rather than just report that they have found a positive test. There's still a chance that this could be an old case. They say if it is an old case of COVID-19, it would have had to be multiple people who have the disease and they've found the wastewater now. But it's funny hearing this and seeing this information. Then tonight I'll be walking to the CBD and there will be thousands of people around and going to their fringe events and at their restaurants. It's a really pumping time for the CBD. So it hasn't caused too much stress or panic within the community, but it'll be interesting to see if anything comes further from it.
Yeah, so you said it was just one case, there'd be no cases linked to it, but how many roughly are there in Adelaide at the moment? What is your, you said about restrictions, what sort of restrictions are you under?
So we were just able to dance again last weekend, which was very fun.
Woo-hoo.
Our restrictions are very light. You know, we have to check in everywhere. I think there was a rule that there could only be 50 people on a dance floor, but I don't really think that they've enforced that too much. We are quite free to move as we are. A lot of the fringe events will have capacity and every fringe event you are sitting a seat away from the person next to you and social distancing is still very much in place, but it does feel like we are quite free. The restrictions aren't that bad.
Just on the topic of wastewater as well, and because I know that that was some testing that we were undertaking here as well, is whether COVID could spread through wastewater. Obviously, they're thinking that's the case in Adelaide. Has it been proven elsewhere in the world that that is a possible way to transmit the virus?
I don't think so. That was definitely one of my initial thoughts when I heard this story, thinking, I mean, not that I'm really hanging out in my toilet water, but what and how is this spreadable? Why is this information that we need to know? Is this something that we need to be concerned about? SA Health has certainly not made us need to be concerned, and the spreading that way I don't think is possible. But wastewater testing is something that we do a lot here for trying to get stats on how many drugs are in Adelaide, so how many people use cocaine or how many people do this, that, the other. So that is something that we've been doing for a very long time. Every year we kind of get a report out about the drug use in South Australia. So it's no surprise to me that they've used this as a test as well. But there is no concern that COVID-19 in the wastewater would cause any spreading.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that about using wastewater to test for drug use. Shall we move on now to our second story for today? Now, I understand this is a bit of an update from last week, and I wasn't here last week, and some of the listeners may also not have been listening last week. I know we have very religious followers who tune in every Thursday Wire, but maybe could you give us a bit of an outline what this is about and what the update this week has been?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll just start by saying this next story will deal with issues of sexual assault and rape. So if that's something that you don't want to hear right now, just turn down your radio for the next few minutes. So this next story is about the Attorney General, Christian Porter, who last week came out as the MP who had historical rape allegations made against him from 1988. He then came out in a press conference in Perth last week where he absolutely denied these allegations and he was very emotional whilst doing so. The allegations come from three anonymous letters that were sent to the Prime Minister and two other MPs. about a woman who made some police reports in 2019. That woman has unfortunately committed suicide in 2020, so she is no longer with us, and that obviously makes this really difficult to report on and also to understand fully. I say difficult because the family obviously are still here and are having to deal with all of this now. It was sent by an anonymous letter, so it's hard to say that the family really gets permission because we don't really know that because the letters were anonymous. So it's a tough situation. Unfortunately, Scott Morrison, our Prime Minister, has declared Christian Porter as, quote, innocent, unquote, and Christian Porter will be remaining in his role as Attorney General, which is one of the highest positions here in Australia. I guess that answers our question of will there be an inquiry into this situation? It looks like the answer is highly a no. Christian Porter is taking some weeks off on mental health leave and then he'll be back business as usual. And it's a real blow to the community and to survivors and the fact that our parliament is so entrenched with this power imbalance. It's frightening and disheartening.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of things that strike me as interesting. The fact that Scott Morrison is saying there can't be an inquiry or anything, and he's citing these rule of law issues. You know, I'm not really sure what he's in reference to there, but I could probably quite fairly say that it sounds as though a prime minister declaring someone innocent is not exactly his job, but I imagine that's something that would best be left to the judiciary or an inquiry. I think this is interesting because in comparison to New Zealand, last year we had a few instances of indecent sexual relations between MPs and junior members of staff or junior members of the community. And I guess the difference being in that case, they admitted the wrong, whereas this case he's denying it, but they were immediately dismissed. So I was wondering, what is it about the culture in Australian politics, do you think, that we're not seeing that?
I think the culture is that our country is already so based on such evil, if I'm frank and honest. And then also right now, currently, our parliament is just absolutely filled with cis white men who have so much power and control. We saw about a month ago as well, Brittany Higgins come out with her story of rape in the parliament when she was a junior staffer, which again has come out at sort of the same time as this story as well. The culture is power and people getting away with the wrong thing. It is really disheartening. Like anyone you talk to here, it is a really disheartening, really distressing, awful thing to think about. I don't know. It's hard to even have a fight for it because it just feels like, as you mentioned, which was an excellent point, it certainly is not Scott Morrison's job to claim anyone as innocent, yet he has. And I think in 20 years' time, these things and these situations will be all what these men will be remembered for. And that gives me a little bit of hope, knowing that history won't look favourably on these people and one day it'll be okay, hopefully. But right now, it feels really tough and terrifying and it feels like there's going to be no change.
I wondered lastly, I know that Christian Porter has taken some time off now for his mental health, and you mentioned that. And I don't doubt that this has been a very difficult time for him, and I fully support that, you know, MPs being open about their mental health struggles, and we had an example of that here last year with Todd Muller. My only concern is the sort of one-sidedness of that, is that there's concern for his mental health, but what about the mental health of the victims? And also, I'm not that familiar with the parties and their policies, but is mental health something that the Liberal Party generally champions, or is it sort of, you know, relying on mental health when it suits them?
I'd say the latter. Obviously, yes, Christian Porter has been very open about his mental health and has taken his time off and has received that time off. But I, you know, the Liberal Party aren't sort of passing incredible policies in Parliament for better mental health for the average person. It's not something that they are fantastic at. So maybe it is when it suits them.
That was Zoe Kounaitis from Radio Adelaide.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
Last year's Auckland University Students Association elections were the most hotly contested in recent memory. The president's office saw five candidates vying for the role. Only one could get it, of course, and that was Anamika Haridaj. 95BFM producer George sat down with her before the third lockdown to get the gist of what AUSA does, what challenges they face, and their goals for this year.
Would you mind quickly introducing yourself and your role at AUSA?
My name is Anamika Hariraj and I am the AUSA president for 2021.
So what do you do as president?
A whole bunch of stuff. Changes every single day. I work really closely with our elected student executive, work alongside a whole bunch of amazing staff to deliver what AUSA does, student voice, student support and student experience.
Yeah, just on that, many students are still somewhat unfamiliar with what AUSA does. Would you be able to tell us about that, maybe go over some of the portfolios on the executive?
So as I've said, we do three main things: student voice, student support and student experience. Under the student voice umbrella, that is when we're sitting on the really big committees and decision-making bodies at the university when we're advocating for students. And we know how to advocate for students because we have a well-established student council now, which is really exciting. That's made up of faculty representatives from across the university. So that's where we go to gather the student voice. Under the student support umbrella, that's helping students who are facing any kind of barriers while studying at the university, whether it's financial hardship, food insecurity, general support through our advocacy service, which is amazing, and we have a great team to help students there. And then there's the fun stuff, the student experience side of things. So there's O-Week coming up next week, which is really, really exciting. We have our orientation concert, which is also super exciting, down at Spark Arena. Pub quizzes, dirty bingos, which I co-host quite often, and that's a lot of fun.
Last year, students had to deal with a large amount of uncertainty and upheaval because of COVID-19. AUSA very publicly lobbied for things like grade bumps, compulsory lecture recordings and free period products. And we got those three. Those three were obviously hugely positive additions to the student experience. But at the same time, there were some things last year that students weren't satisfied with, particularly uncertainty around end of year examinations, whether they would be in person or online. Would you like to quickly run through what you thought were some of the victories and some of the losses from last year?
I think one of our biggest wins last year would have had to have been the universal grade bump that was applied for semester one classes. We worked really hard to advocate for that, and that was great to see that, you know, get over the line. I think in semester two, decision-making around exams was one of our biggest challenges, and I think the main challenge for us there was that AUSA wasn't sitting at the table when those decisions were being made, and that was really difficult for us to talk to the university about what students really want, because our consultation process was foolproof. It was solid. We knew, we consulted with students, we consulted with a whole range of student groups around campus, but it's difficult to advocate for what students want when we're not allowed to be in the decision-making room.
Building on that, in an interview with Crackham last year, you said that student representation and university decision-making would be your main focus this year. In particular, the representation of marginalised groups. Given that sometimes last year there was a lack of student voice at the decision-making table, how exactly do you hope to achieve this? What systems do you plan to implement? What processes are in place?
So there's a few things that we're working on within that space. One of the things is establishing subcommittees for our student council, and we're getting our portfolio members on the executive to lead that. So our women's rights officer, our queer rights officer, international students officer, and our welfare officer are working on creating subcommittees for our student council where we provide an open platform to students to come to and tell us, actually, here's what I've been experiencing either within my faculty, or here's a barrier that I've you know, come across when accessing a support service at the university. And all of those student voices feed back to our student council. So we start to see trends, we see anything major come up, and we know what to advocate for from there. Another part of that actually is a committee that the Vice-Chancellor is wanting to establish in partnership with AUSA, which we very briefly spoke about last week. But getting that across the line, working with AUSA senior leadership team and the university senior executive is going to be really exciting.
Well, obviously, you see a lot of potential for good in AUSA. Yes. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't be a part of it. What excites you most about being in AUSA over the next year?
There's quite a few things going on. One of the main things, I think, is the university's new strategic plan. When I first started at AUSA, I was very focused on my specific portfolio, whether it was in my role as a women's rights officer or as a welfare VP last year. But now I'm not thinking to the 31st of November when I leave. I'm thinking 5 years' time. What can we do this year that's going to make sure that AUSA is in the best possible position that it's ever been in? And that kind of stuff is really exciting for me. Working closely with our general manager and our advisory board on that is going to be great.
Would you like to just briefly touch on what some of those long-term goals are?
I think a lot of it is growing AUSA's services to be exactly what students need. Right now, we are running on the most minimum viable product. And part of that is showing the university how efficiently and how effectively we are working and how hard we're working as an executive. And we've really grown. You know, the AUSA that I walked into 2 years ago is completely different to the one that I work for right now. And to see that progress and to see that change over the past 2 years has been amazing. And I see a lot of potential in AUSA. I've seen where it was, and I am looking at 5 years ahead to see where it can be, and that's really exciting to me.
Now, final question. COVID-19 continues to loom large in students' minds and memories. Alongside this, what do you see being the biggest issues for students going into 2021?
I think a lot of the major issues that students are facing are products of the impacts of COVID. So a lot of that is things like financial hardship. A lot of students are casual and part-time workers who have lost their jobs. Within my portfolio last year as well for VP, I processed every single hardship grant application that came through. A vast majority of them were from international students who weren't able to go home, who aren't able to access the money in their bank accounts because of laws in their home countries, have lost a lot of family members. That's had a big impact. Of course, accommodation is another big one. Living in Auckland's very, very expensive, and we all know that. That's another major barrier. But it's all things that we're working towards supporting our students through. So the support is there, but just telling everyone to reach out is the difficult part. Yeah.
Thank you very much. This has been good.
Cool. Thank you very much.
And that was Anamika Hariraj, AUSA's president for 2021, speaking about last year's difficulties and this year's prospects.
I'm disappointed by the government these days. Sometimes they just need a good kick in the backside.
The Wire. Zero emissions, no parking hassles, no traffic. Make your commute fun.
Get on a scooter at Freed, West Haven Drive, your micro-mobility e-scooter specialist.
Freed Electric Scooters is the place to go for all your e-scootering needs. Their full-service workshop covers all brands of e-scooters. Plus, they're the exclusive agent for top-of-the-line zero electric scooters.
Freed Electric Scooters. Fun, safe and easy to ride. Find out more at freedpev.co.nz.
Yeah. Oh, man, this is so crazy.
You guys got anything to eat?
Holy crap! The lucky taco truck just crashed through the flipping wall. There goes the bond.
Anyone for tacos?
Couldn't we just order online?
I mean, yeah, you could. But the atmosphere, man.
The Lucky Taco Fiesta Kit. Everything you need to make authentic, delicious tacos at your place. Get them from Faro Fresh or order online at theluckytaco.co.nz for free delivery anywhere Auckland-wide. The Lucky Taco, bringing Mexican street food to your place since way back.
Sorry, no goths.
Excuse me?
Yeah, piss off. Maybe without those sunnies you could read the bloody sign.
No goths? This is cruel and unusual.
Not as cruel and unusual as that beautiful velvet cape. Now get out of my sight, Nosferatu.
I'm a human being.
It's hard out there for a goth, but everyone's welcome on Penny's 1 to 4. A heady mix of the sounds of now and the shimmering hits from our alternative past. The 1 to 4 with Penny, every Monday only on 95 BFM.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Now, you may have seen some recent news stories about a study which shows what happens to the brain of a zebrafish when it listens to this song.
You can't touch this. You can't touch this. You can't touch this. You can't touch this.
That was conducted by DJ and neuroscientist Rebecca Paulson at the Scott Lab of the Queensland Brain Institute. The purpose of the experiment was to show how we can use zebrafish to better understand auditory processing in humans, especially those with disorders such as autism spectrum disorder or schizophrenia. Now, here at BFM, we have the insider scoop. my very own sister, Maya Wild, who is also a PhD student at the Queensland Brain Institute. And that is her fish in the video, and she was actually the one to press play on the song. So I began by asking her the very important question, why Can't Touch This by MC Hammer?
So firstly, Rebecca, who is the main person who's done all the work on this study, has said that she was a pretty big MC Hammer fan as a kid. But also MC Hammer himself has gotten really into science communication on Twitter. So we hoped that if we made this recording and sent it out to MC Hammer that he might pick up on it and share the word about this cool paper that had been done.
I did not know that. Yeah. That's incredible.
And on, you know, his Twitter and also Rebecca's Twitter, you can find the video of the fish brain responding to Can't Touch This, which is definitely worth a watch.
I guess to describe what's going on in the video, if people were to watch it, what are they seeing happening there?
So in response to MC Hammer's song, you can see all these different neurons lighting up in different parts of the brain. When different parts of the song happens, you have the snare drum in one place lights up, and you have the vocals in a group of neurons in a different place lights up. It's really amazing.
And so why zebrafish in particular?
So what's really amazing about zebrafish, especially when they're young like this, is that they're completely transparent. So the skin and the skull, everything is transparent. So you can put a microscope above them and see everything in their whole brain. And so we can genetically modify them so that their neurons light up green when they're active. And that means that while they're sitting underneath the microscope, we can then focus up and down throughout the brain over time and see which neurons are active and what's going on in the brain. And then also see what's going on in the brain in response to sounds being played to the fish.
And in terms of similarity to human brains, zebrafish are actually quite similar, apparently.
Well, so they're also vertebrates. They have a spine, which generally in the animal kingdom means that you're at least reasonably close in terms of your brain layout. One thing that they don't have is the cortex, which is the kind of wrinkly bit that we have on the outside of our brain. But that's actually kind of another benefit, because in a human or another mammal, if you want to look at the bits that are underneath the cortex, it's difficult because the cortex is in the way. Whereas in this case, you don't have to look through a cortex at all.
So what is the study actually about?
So it's about auditory processing in the zebrafish. And previously, people didn't really think that the zebrafish could tell apart many different sounds or that it could hear a lot of different frequencies. And part of the reason for that is that they're using a speaker above the water, right? So, you know, when you're in a swimming pool, if your head's underneath the water, you can't really hear what's going on above the water that well. So what Rebecca has done is actually designed a speaker where the front part of the speaker that vibrates is a piece of glass, which is part of the chamber where the zebrafish is in. So on the other side of the glass is the water. So the sound just goes directly into the water. And she's played a bunch of different frequencies and a bunch of different types of sounds, like ones that are increasing in volume, ones that go kind of woo or woo. And the zebrafish can tell all of these different things apart. It can hear way more frequencies than anybody thought that it could. And we can actually see where in the brain all of these different things are processed.
I wanted to ask what the point of this experiment was in terms of the broader scheme of things and what that study aims to achieve.
So zebrafish are actually used a lot in research and in neuroscience. Previously, people thought that they didn't have a particularly complicated or sophisticated ability to hear, which means that nobody was really using them for anything to do with investigating the auditory system in a really deep and complicated way. What Rebecca's shown is that they can actually hear way more frequencies than anyone thought. So now that opens the door for us to do a lot more complicated auditory tests, ones that model auditory tests that can be done in humans and in other mammals, including ones that can be done in humans to find differences in sensory processing in certain disorders like autism spectrum disorder.
Yeah, and so tell me a bit more about that, because that's kind of the end goal of this research, right, is to help people with those disorders. How do we go from MC Hammer to that?
Yeah, so it's really about understanding what is happening in the circuit level at the individual neurons, how they communicate to each other. What's different between someone that has autism spectrum disorder compared to someone who doesn't in terms of the way that their brains process sound? And, you know, a lot of people with ASD have hypersensitivity to sound, so they can react really strongly or get really stressed out. And this is about delving way down into the brain.
Is there anything else you'd like to add on top of that?
What's really exciting about this study is that you can see every single neuron in the brain of a zebrafish while it's alive and perfectly healthy and not anesthetized or anything like that, which is not something that you can do in any other animal, certainly not in humans. So the amount of information we can get about how sound is processed out of these zebrafish is really quite amazing. Another thing that is just amazing to think about, anytime you're thinking about neurons and how they work together and how they can understand something and make sense of it, is think about how tiny the head of that zebrafish is, right? It's like 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter or even less. And the amount of computation that that tiny brain can do, you know, our computers are huge compared to that, and they are on a similar level.
That was my sister, Maya Wild, a PhD student from the Queensland Brain Institute, talking about the research by Rebecca Paulson on auditory process, zebrafish, and MC Hammer. Let's hear it one more time.
You can't touch this. You can't touch this. You can't touch this. You can't touch this.
That was The Wire.
Yes, koeira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. And that is the Thursday Wire for this week. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa, I kōrero mai ki a mātou mō tēnei rā. Thank you to everyone who spoke to us today. We had Minister Andrew Little, Manu Kalon, Zoe Konaris, Anamika Hariraj, and tōku tuakana, my sister, Maya Wild. A big thank you to Anika and George behind the scenes for those pieces, and for Jemima helping me out, our news chief. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Also a big thanks to all of you who tuned in, called us and sent in some texts. Some were asking how to make those donations to Merge Cafe. I think I repeated it there at the end, but you can make that on LifeWise website. I found it just by googling LifeWise. And ka hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. We'll be back next week, but of course you'll have Justin back then in his regular slot. Up next, you've got the 1-4 with Sigrid. And I'm going to leave you with a song now. It's not Can't Touch This by MC Hammer, but it is 911 is a Joke by Public Enemy. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.